This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I'm recovering from BoucherCon 2018. It was so much fun. That was the big convention here in St. Petersburg for all of the most famous and best-selling mystery writers from all over the world. It was so exciting, and I was so thrilled that I got to meet and be with so many of the guests who have been on my program before. I was, I can't even begin to say which ones were my favorite, but maybe I will say that Ian Rankin... This guy is gorgeous. He is so wonderful. I was thrilled with him, and I was so happy to. I could sit around a bar with him all day long. He was lots of fun, and of course, one of my favorite, of course, was Lee Child, who was there. And it was funny. I took a photo with him, and he is so tall, and I was wearing high heels, and I look like a little kid next to him. I knew, you know, when I talked to him when he was on the program, we talked, and, you know, he mentioned he's 6'5" or something like that. And so I knew he was tall. And that's, of course, Jack Reacher in Lee's books is described as 6'5", blue-eyed, blonde, and, of course, as Lee will say, handsome. And he is, indeed. But somehow, until you actually stand next to him, you don't realize what it means. So it was so much fun, and I so enjoyed getting to spend time with him. And I will be having, I have to catch up with all of my interviews and getting everything up on my webpage, because it has been really overwhelming. I've been getting so many books. I think I've gotten so far maybe 40, 50 books from people who were at BoucherCon. I think there were over 300 writers there. And so I want to thank everybody for sending in their books. And I'm reading them as fast as I can. But today I have a wonderful guest. And he's been on the program before. And it was, a year ago. And, of course, he's been busy. Like all writers, once they start writing, they can't stop because they know the joy on paper. So I'm so happy to welcome to the program today Mark LaPorta. And he has a new book, and it's part of a new series. And the new book is called Probability Shadow. And we'll let him tell us about this new series he's writing. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. How are you?
Wow, I'm great. I'm still so hyped up from the BoucherCon convention here for mystery writers. So I'm looking forward to now. I'm going to go to the next sci-fi writers convention because it's just so much fun to be around so many writers.
Well, that's nice to know. We do our best to keep you happy.
Well, definitely. Well, and now the new book. Woo! As I said, Probability Shadow is part of a new series that you're starting, and it's called, what's the new series called?
It's called Against the Glare of Darkness. It's a long-range story of a fight against evil, and of course, ultimately the recognition that evil is an integral part of the universe and not something that can really be stomped out, but may be adapted to, and so on. And in this case, there is a central mystery. It's not a mystery novel, but there's a little bit of mystery. There's an interstellar civilization. We're looking at about 3,000 years in the future. It's a vast interstellar civilization that's been disrupted by an emerging evil, a species of mutants that's been trapped in a multidimensional prison for many thousands of years, has come forward and created a crisis using their unprecedented control of probability. They've managed to create an artificial shortage of rare minerals that are absolutely essential to artificial intelligence and space travel, and of course that's the backbone of the interstellar civilization. So what we have is a band of sort of mismatched aliens, let's say, from different species, who unite under the banner of a sentient crustacean to, you know, stop the onslaught of the ancient race, which is known as the Quishiks, and their quest to destroy really all of sentient life, because they feed on mental energy. And you have the political powers, once the shortage is created, are fighting against each other. You've got the Terran Protectorate, which is a sort of human empire, military and economic, and slightly fascist, we should say. You have the on the other hand, the crustaceans, the Richard Sidereal Caucus. They're more philosophical and ethical, and they offer a different way for planets to unite, you know, in more of a benign relationship. Then you have the Caldex Assembly, which is a group of symbiotes that have their own stealthy agenda. They sneak in and out of other beings' bodies and learn their secrets and use that to manipulate the stock market and the banking industry. And so they've got a whole sort of empire of their own that's in the shadows. And one of the central part of the central population is an isolated species called the Drawline that live on planet Ladrone, where the story opens up, because Ladrone is one of the few places left in the settled universe that has a sufficient supply of these rare minerals. And so all these political powers are converging there for an interstellar trade conference to try to get the lion's share of that. And it's to that planet that Ambassador Ungen Draff of Grishard comes to do what he thinks is a simple negotiation, until he uncovers the emergence of the Quishiks, and the whole thing starts to unravel from there.
Wow. I as I said, last year when you were on and we were talking about the changing heart of Ixtahan Daharak, I was impressed with your ability to come out with characters that were so believable and wonderful names. And I think that's part of the fun of your books. Now, sometimes people will say, well, you know, the name sounds strange. But it's funny, once you get into this, once one starts reading your book, I just found that, first of all, I got to know the characters. And I don't know where you get all these names. Names from you've got a lot of stuff in that head of yours, and it reminds me a little bit of Mike Resnick. You know, Mike Resnick, of course, is the sci-fi. He is like the grandfather of sci-fi here, because he has won, I think, every sci-fi award. And I've always told him that, you know, I would just love to, you know, be in one of those little capsules that goes around in his brain, because it must be so fascinating. But I think you have the same brain, because you have a lot of things in there.
Yeah, I contain multitude. And, of course, creating all those names is a very important way to keep everything distinct. I mean, I've got four or five different species and civilizations that I want people to keep clear in their heads. So I created a distinctive body of names for each just so that there's just very little confusion whose interests are being represented when somebody's talking.
Well, I so enjoy, the minute I started reading about Ambassador Ungen Draff, is that the right way to pronounce it?
Yes, Ungen Draff, yes. He's known as Har Ungen Draff formally, but anyway.
Well, I thought he was a fascinating character, and all of them, it's just like one after another, you have so many. So let's, you know, why don't you just tell us a little bit more about some of the characters, and then we can hear the pronunciation, so that when people are reading the book, they'll be able to, you know, read along with you, and just tell us more about some of the characters. I liked, for example, you have Shoal, which is, I think,
right.
and Yaldrick, and how do you pronounce Lalamfor?
Oh, Dalalamfor. She's the Outre AI. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Well, we can start with Ungen himself. Ungen Draff is a distinguished crustacean, an ambassador from the Grishard Sidereal Caucus. He's
approaching his 100th year. He's been in the diplomatic corps for 80 years. The Burchardi lived longer, much longer than the humans do, so it's not so unusual for him to be. But he's still getting on in years, and he's decided to take, he was thinking of retiring, he's decided to take one last diplomatic mission because he's still trying to get over the grief of the loss of his daughter, his adult daughter, Florent, who was murdered by some terrorists. She was a journalist. She wanted to investigate the Kresovic militant camp. She went in there to interview one of the leaders and was executed. So he's got a heavy heart. He figures, I've got to have a change of scene. So he accepts this diplomatic mission, and that's what places him in the middle of this vast interstellar conflict.
Now he's from Grishard.
That's right.
And tell us a little bit about Grishard.
Well, Grishard is a planet very distant from Earth. It's a society that values philosophy, ethical considerations. They have a very liberal mindset. They're a real contrast to the Terran Protectorate, who uses muscle and might and intimidation to pull people together. They have open trade agreements, open borders, that kind of thing. And everything is, they're very cultured in one way, but they're also very hedonistic. I mean, everything in their society revolves around comfort and graciousness and even-temperedness and rationality and that kind of thing. So they're not given to extremes. And they are always looking for the most ethical path through things. And you would say that their planet is, their cities are very beautiful and cultured and all that kind of thing. The level of education is very high. It's that kind of an environment. You've already mentioned Saul, who is a Kresovic. Now, the Kresovics are a genetically altered branch of the human race. Early on, when the humans were the first out of the gate with interstellar travel of all of these different sentient worlds, and there's a lot of problem with radiation and pressure and so on and so forth, and the humans were having trouble establishing the colonies because it was too dangerous. So, an Eastern European geneticist named Nikola Kresovic came up with a way to remap the genome. This is again in the very far future of humanity, so that a certain select group would have some of the properties of radiation-resistant beetles, so they could withstand higher levels of radiation, higher levels of pressure, get along with a little less oxygen. And so for many generations, for centuries, the Kresovics were the advanced team building the infrastructure for a colony so that the humans could settle it. But then what happened was, after a while, technology improved, because it was much cheaper to use the Kresovics than to build all the specialized robots and machinery that they would need to do this. But several centuries later, the humans reached the point where it was really not so difficult for them or expensive to build the robotics that they needed, and the Kresovics became obsolete. And there were already a lot of people who thought, well, why do we want these scummy mutants around anyway? Because they look different. They have slightly greenish skin. They have an elongated skull. They have hair that's very different from human hair. You would still say they were related to humans in the way they looked, but they're clearly, different looking. And so they were shunned as mutants and relegated to the less prosperous planets. And they had a lot of technical skills, so they were able to find jobs on lesser planets that needed technical support. But of course, they couldn't really earn enough money to support themselves, and that's where the terrorist group grew up from in response to that, because they were really being discriminated against by the humans. Now, Saul has no direct connection to that. It's just that he happens to be a Kresovic. He's an orphan, and he's been living on the street since he was 9, and he had worked for a crime boss on one of the sort of lesser worlds. But one day, he manages, he's delivering this sort of top secret, it's actually a bracelet, but there's a lot more to it, and to one of his clients, and he accidentally sees the client's face, and so that's a big no-no, and so someone chases him down and throws him into this horrible, horrible prison, and eventually the person who throws him in the prison, the reason she does it is because she recognizes that the bracelet is actually part of a large interstellar conspiracy, and she wants to make sure that the boy doesn't say anything about the bracelet to anybody else. So she throws him in the prison, then she goes to the leader of the draw line who are on the ground and, you know, negotiates so that this boy is brought to Legrand for questioning. And there's a complicated reason for why that particular planet has been chosen, because Legrand is right near a black hole, the Fremdel event horizon, where as the symbiotes know, the evil Krishix have been trapped in that region for a long time, and they're about to emerge. So it's hard to explain in a few words. But anyway, so he's sitting there in Legrand, and he's very unruly, and the leader of the draw line that Ungen has been sent to work with says, well, can you help me teach the manners to this boy? And so eventually he becomes Scholl's tutor, and together they get involved further in solving the crisis. It's a bit more long-winded than I intended. But anyway, there are also two representatives of the Terran Protectorate, Captain Harlan Mars and his exo, Dillian Cavendish. She hails from a region of Earth curiously known as Great Britain for reasons no one can remember, so she has a slight accent and speaks in that slightly curious way. And the two of them have a sort of off-center relationship. They're definitely part of the Terran Protectorate, but they feel a little queasy sometimes about what they're being ordered to do. There's also, as I was mentioning, the draw line, that the head of the draw line world government is Shadron Drashna, who has a 7-year-old daughter named Koronia, who will become much more important in book two. Let's see, who else am I leaving out? Well, then there's the symbiote who's the one that captured Scholl and put him in the prison. Her name is Warpex, and she's very much a cynical, self-serving, but extremely effective and efficient being who knows how to get what she wants. And she has an early encounter with Ungent. Let's see, am I leaving out anyone?
Well,
really significant.
No,
enough to work with.
I think that is, and it. Now, normally, I'll tell you the truth. Normally, I don't let authors just, you know, talk about all their characters, but I specifically wanted you to do so because I think that you have created here. You know, for anyone, now I love sci-fi, and I so enjoy going into it and just the escape of sci-fi. But I think that for anyone who doesn't have a background in reading sci-fi, I think reading this book is a great way to start because, as I said, one, you do develop your characters so beautifully. They have depth. They have personalities that one can really relate to, and that there is this challenge. You know, when you're writing sci-fi, that you do have to have some different name, something different. And once somebody reads your books, they will remember these characters. And with the names that are now, right now, you know, when you first read them and you see like a strange combination of letters that might not, you know, don't look particularly, you know, they're not Tom, Dick, and Harry. But
right.
once you get into it, like Ungent, once you start to know these characters, you remember their names and you remember their personalities, which is so vital in getting people involved in a book. And now, of course, you're planning this as a big saga of a lot of books, right?
Well, a trilogy.
A trilogy.
I'm working on book two now, and it extends the themes of, you know, that are developed here and takes it to the next level, and then book three will bring some kind of resolution, which will be unexpected. And one of the distinctions I make is not only between humans and unfamiliar species, but also between those and androids. There are a couple of different classes of artificial intelligence. There's Yaldrant, who is Ungent's assistant, and right now she's in
mostly in, she's inside a casing. She's not mobile, so he has to bring her everywhere. But she's often, you know, correcting him or getting his thinking on track, or, you know, just balancing out some of his thinking. And he relies on her very heavily. And she has her own personality. She's extremely polite. She has a mellow sort of alto voice, and speaks very, very formally, but with a lot of warmth in a certain way.
Well, this is the fun of your book and of talking to you, is that they're so real to you. Now, I have to take a little commercial break, but I want you to hold on, because I want to talk to you about sci-fi, and I want to talk to you in general. Just a minute, Ed. I want to also, Ed, do we have a new commercial ready to air today? Yeah? Okay, one or two? Okay, we can air two new commercials from a new sponsor of Joy on Paper, and I want to thank him so much for doing this for me. And then we're going to have my two other commercials, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk more to Mark Laporta about sci-fi in general and about some of the ideas that he has in his books, because it is just fascinating. So let's play the new commercials, and I want to thank the sponsor for doing this for me.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
WTAN Radio is proud to announce that local author and speaker Glenn Erickson will soon be a guest on Pat Z's Joy on Paper program. He will tell you how he got his start and how you too can become an accomplished writer, author, and speaker. Glenn Erickson has published self-help books as well as speculative fiction stories and novels. All of his books are available on Smashwords.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you could move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With the Z, and I am back with Mark Laporta to talk about his first book, Probability Shadow, the first in his new trilogy, Against the Glare of Darkness. Hey, Mark. It's so nice to have you on the program today, because, as I said, I think, first of all, I love sci-fi, because you do get sort of out of this world, literally. And then the nice thing, you bring in so many ideas and concepts that it makes one think. And I like a book where I start wondering, well, will this exist? Will this happen? And simple things like, you mentioned sublight speed, and you where do you get all the technical stuff that you put into your books?
Well, some of it is sort of traditional science fiction lore, but, you know, I try to go beyond, you know, I don't just copy down from movies and books. I try to look things up and get as much science. I'm not a scientist, but I try to use as much correct scientific terminology as I can, even when I'm coming up with something that doesn't exist, so it has a framework that's more believable, and also I have the restraint that you need to keep a story from flying off the handle, because, of course, when you're writing, if you just write anything that comes into your head, you're going to have an amorphous blob that, you know, in other words, a story with no rules doesn't actually exist as a story. Your world doesn't have any boundaries. So within reason, I just try to, you know, I'm a graduate of Google University and Wikipedia College, and I, you know, you try to get the terminology right, get everything. And what I do is I stay just within what I know and what I understand. I don't go beyond it. I just kind of have clear facts and then allude to a few things and then move on, because I don't really want the story to get bogged down in deep scientific detail, because it doesn't interest me to write hard science fiction. That's a completely different genre. And I've read there's some great examples, like by the author Stephen Baxter, for example, where he has a mission to explore the interior of the sun. And it's, you know, it's fascinating, but it's not the kind of story I want to write. I'm more interested in characters and emotions and that kind of thing.
Well, you certainly do. As I said, your character development is so good. And as when one is reading your books, and this goes for the last trilogy and now the beginning of this one, I really started to care about the characters, and even the characters without a body. You know, I cared about them, and I wanted to know more, and I wanted to see the development. And I think that's why your book, you know, I get a lot of sci-fi books, and I love sci-fi, but I thought, wow, this really stands out from so many, because it just grabs you.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's what I'm focused on, is the character. The characters are, I mean, it's a little cute to say the characters are telling me the story, but I do, when I'm working on things, I think, well, what's happening next in this character's mind, and I allow that to affect what's going on. So, of course, you know, you start with some general idea of what the plot should be or what direction you're going in. But if I find that I've created a situation where the characters can't be themselves, then I just have to, you know, push that aside and think of a new way forward for the story or for the book. Because that really is what brings it to life to me. That's what makes the book entertaining and also moving. I'm not interested. Again, it's all about personal preference rather than philosophy. Some people really value having a thrilling plot per se, and an intricate plot with twists of particular kinds, and that's definitely one way to go. But my real interest is character.
Now you mentioned that you're not a scientist. You're not that's not your background. What's your background?
Well, I mean, I do have a little bit of science in the background, in the sense that my father was a research chemist. He worked in rubbers and plastics, and I have had a brother who was, you know, a programmer. So I grew up kind of in a scientific background, and I'm very interested in that. But I've spent most of my life in the arts, and I've earned my living for many years in advertising as a copywriter. So, you know, that sort of creative side. I also studied music for many years, and I still write music. And so most of my impetus to write books, or my background for writing books, comes from just the kind of an artist's observation, because an artist is an observer first and foremost, I think. And I think the interest that if the characters have that kind of depth, it's because I've always been observing and making notes of not really so consciously, but I absorb easily different types of people, different situations. And of course, there's so much going on the world stage to use as a model for, you know, a book about interstellar intrigue, but that helps a lot. There's a lot of material there to draw from.
Were you always interested in sci-fi? Was that your sort of love from the time you were a child?
Yeah, I was always fascinated. Well, I was always fascinated by a couple of things. One was astronomy. I didn't have the patience to be. I never had the patience to be a scientist. I mean, you really have to love details and data. And I mean, I appreciate that and I value it, but I don't have the patience for it in some ways. But I was also interested in archaeology. I was absolutely insane about ancient Egypt when I was little, and things like medieval armor. And I guess what you say they had in common is they were all otherworldly. You know, if everyday life can get very much the same, but you look at a piece of medieval armor with all of the scrolling. I mean, you know, the dress armor, not the battle armor. The plumes, the colors, the different metals. It's quite something. And the same with ancient Egyptians or the Mayans. And so, you know, science fiction had an ability to also take you out of that era, out of that sort of everyday realm. I also, of course, as like everybody else, got enthralled with The Lord of the Rings and the whole idea of world building there, because, I mean, if you want to talk about world building, there's no better example. I was just talking to someone about how, you know, he wrote the novels, but he preceded the novels with years and years of just notes about this culture that is behind it, you know, not writing novels at all, but inventing all the elfin languages and so on and so forth. So he went the total world building route and then decided, oh, maybe I'll write a novel. You know, yeah. It was almost like it was an afterthought. I mean, I may not have that exactly right, but that's the way it seems sometimes, that he was doing all of this because he was a language scholar. He was doing all of this in his spare time and then said, oh, I could make a novel out of this. Anyway, so that's my answer, that there are all those different influences. I grew up reading a lot of Isaac Asimov. I must have read every one of his major novels and every one of his short stories.
Oh, so did I. I was obsessed with him I had like a 2-year obsession with him that I had to read everything he ever wrote.
Well, mine lasted longer than 2 years, and I finally got to the point where I said, okay, that's enough. You know, I must have read Foundation's Edge, for example, in particular. For some reason, that book really got to me. I must have read that at least 6 times. I don't usually do that at all, but there's just something about, first of all, there's something about his point of view. It's so broad, even though, you know, he was a scientist. He didn't write like a scientist. He wrote like someone with a broader humanistic education. I mean, he wrote a lot about Shakespeare, and sometimes in his lighter stories, short stories, you had mentioned Gilbert and Sullivan. There's a whole short story of his where it's all just puns about Gilbert and Sullivan that would make you cringe. So he had a very interesting point of view about society in general, and I think some of that definitely seeped into my bones. So in some ways, it isn't necessarily science fiction. It was just the mind of a particular person that happened to be writing in this medium. But I've also, I mean, when I did try to write, it took me many years to get to the point where I felt like I'd found my voice and I had the courage to actually say, yes, I can write a novel. I'd write shorter things, but I always felt I could write my more characteristic, the stuff that was really coming from the best place was the stuff that involved some element of fantasy or science fiction or otherworldly elements, because that's what would get me excited. I'd respond to the fact that it wasn't the everyday thing, you know, domestic disputes or car accidents or whatever.
Well, I think, as I said, I think your books are so enjoyable. I think that for people, and this is, you know, one of the things that for people who have not read sci-fi, this is a good book, I think, to start, because there's something, I don't know, I found something very reassuring. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but there's something in there. There's a kind of hopefulness that I think, although there are all sorts of problems in the future, and we have all these things, you know, sort of some of society's problems are reflected in your book. But right. There is an underlying, I don't know, a hopefulness that I found in the books. But otherwise, it would have been too depressing, you know?
It has a lot to do with how I see things. I mean, a lot of the problems that we have are the problems that we create for ourselves, but we also have very much the resources to solve the problem. It's all a matter of mindset. And in this story, it takes this major crisis with this enemy that's going to, threatens to consume everybody, that people realize, well, wait, what are our real best interests and where are the ways that we have to pull together and forget about the old battles that we fought amongst each other and
join together and cooperate. So I think that's why I finished the book and I said, first I'm looking forward to the next one, but then I'm saying, okay, I think it's going to work out. I hope it's going to work out. And I said, Mark's doing a great job here. And I wanted to mention also that you are published by Chickadee Prince, and they are a wonderful little publishing house.
Yes, it's a Chickadee Prince Books. It's a small press based in Brooklyn, and they publish not just science fiction. There is another science fiction writer, Stephen Drachman, but there's also literary fiction. There's someone who spent his career as a lawyer who writes, you know, sort of crime drama. I was just editing a book by an author that has done a big military extravaganza in the near future, but it, you know, could have been written about World War II just as easily in some ways. So it's a very wide range. There's a woman who writes about Donna Levin, who writes about autism, autistic children a lot. So that's a wide range of things.
Well, it's a very what I love about them is they're so enthusiastic about their authors, and I always like that when publishers come to me and say, okay, this book you really have to read. We want you to enjoy it. And so I want to thank really Chickadee Prince, because I think that they turned me on to you with the previous trilogy, and I want to thank them for that, because I'm always looking for books that are just a little bit different, that are have that special, I don't know, I always get sort of a special tingle when I say, okay, I want people to read this book. And so I want to thank them, and I want to thank you so much, Mark. You said you're working on the second book, almost done?
Yes. Well, it's well past the first draft. I'm refining it now, but it's definitely complete in all of its essentials. I'm just trying to refine the language and make everything as clear as possible.
Now, are you one of these people who you outline everything, or do you have writers are always asking me, or are all the people who listen to my program who want to write and they dream about writing, and then they say, well, I don't know how I can do it, I don't know if I can find time. How do you organize your time so that you can write?
Well, it's easier if you have a fire in your belly and you just can't stand a day where you aren't productive, and that's sort of where I am. But, I can't say that I don't outline. What I do is I have a general idea of what the book's going to be about, and I'll get started with part of it that's very clear, and then one thing will follow after another, and then I'll get to a certain point and I say, well, I know that, let's say I'm in letter B of my tentative outline, but I don't know how to get to letter D because I don't know what letter C is. So I start making notes about what the next step would be and what the ramifications are. And then I'll go again, I'll have a clearer path, and then I'll say, oh, this isn't clear. So in other words, I make myself notes as I go, rather than sitting down and saying, this is exactly how everything is going to happen. And I think it's largely because I am listening to the characters and I'm involved in where their personalities and their actions and their characteristics are taking the story. So I leave that open. And then, at any point, if I feel something's not working, I'll throw it out. And, you know, I'll rewrite the whole first half of the book if I have to. Unfortunately, it doesn't come to that. But, I mean, my goal is not to have the particular book that I outlined on day one, but to have an entertaining book that makes sense and has all the attributes that I like. And so I'll just do anything. I put in only the things that move the story forward. And anything that doesn't, who needs it? And I would say anybody who dreams of writing, just stop dreaming and write anything. Get out the computer, get out the pad. If you want to use one of those software programs, I don't, because it's just not my personal preference, but some people find it useful. But I would say just start without that and tell a story of any kind, because the only way to write is to continue to write, and then you'll find your facility. I start the thing that finally gave me my confidence is I've been writing advertising for so many years. I wrote a very long brochure and a number of things in a very short time, and I say, hey, I have facility with writing. Why shouldn't I be able to write a book? You know, because I had ideas, but I lacked the confidence somehow. So it was just the continual writing, because when you're advertising, you just write, and you're a copywriter, you write all day long, huge volumes. And what that does for you is the words just flow out, and you start thinking in structures instead of, you know, individual sentences. And that's another thing. It's not to fuss over individual words while you're writing. Just get it out there somewhere. What I do, I'll write, and I'll say, I don't know exactly how to say this, but I know what I'm getting at, and I'll just do it. And I'll go back a few days later and say, oh, my God, that paragraph's got to go. But I knew what I meant to say, and so I can refine it as I go. So you don't fuss over details. And just tell a story that you know. It doesn't have to be that you're going to start with your Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. I mean, even just give yourself the exercise of saying, and write in first person or third person or even second person, but, you know, whatever works for you. But, you know, if it's like, you know, Harry went to the grocery store, that's the story. Can we elaborate? Harry limped on his way to the grocery store. Harry's limp made him bump into a woman who was walking in the other direction. They got into talking. I mean, you know, so in other words...
Exactly. You know, what you just said is exactly what all the people who are dreaming about writing have to think about. First of all, just to find that joy of getting those first words on paper. And that's right. Why I named this program Joy on Paper, because it is such a joy when you actually put the words down on paper and you see them and you say, I did it. And then you can say, I can do it better, but at least you start.
Right. And the other thing is not to worry about whether this is going to be the perfect book or whether, and not to worry, oh, well, what if somebody reads this and they think I'm crazy? Well, you know, again, just, or they think something else about me that, you know, well, there is that. If you're going to write something, you're going to reveal something about yourself. So you can't worry about that. But you also have control about how much you reveal and so on. So, I mean, it's not something to really worry about, but just, You don't write to be famous. You don't write to get published even. You write to write, and you write to tell the story in the most authentic way that you can. And if you do that and you stay true to yourself and you keep developing your craft, by mostly by work. I mean, you can take classes. You can read articles. There's some use that has. But I think the main thing is to just keep going with it. Then the work will start to glow in some way. It'll start to resonate with other people, and you might end up getting a nice interview from Patsy Gill someday, and that'll be quite an early pinnacle in your career, and that'll be very useful to you. I mean, it's all just writing because it means something to you. What I get out of the writing is so much more than, you know, if I were to win an award or, I mean, sure, I'd love to make a billion dollars off this book and have it made into a movie and all that other stuff. I'm not saying I don't, but that's not what's driving me to do it. I've got stuff to say, and I finally found a way to say it that I've been wanting to say for many, many years, And now it's coming out through these books, and it just feels great.
Well, I think you say it beautifully. And the new book is a space opera for adults, and it's called Probability Shadow. It's the first book in the new trilogy called Against the Glare of Darkness, and it's available wherever books are sold. And do you have a website you want people to visit?
Well, you can go to chickadeeprince.com to get more information about the book. I also have a Facebook page that's called Heart of Earth, the science fiction website. You can find that on Facebook. And there I publish short fiction on a regular basis that's unrelated to any of the novels, although you can find links to my novels and a recording of me reading the first chapter of the first book of Heart of Earth, in other words, the first book of the previous series, and I'll be posting readings from this book fairly soon, so you can hear me read.
Okay.
So I don't have a separate website.
No, that's fine. I will actually post your Facebook page on my website too when I will upload this interview, so you can share it with your Facebook friends. And again, Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. I know that you'll be back probably next year as soon as you have the new book coming out. And again, thank you so much for giving me a wonderful read, because I really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks so much, Patsy, and thanks for having your show. And, it's really great to have the support.
Okay. Well, talk to you next year. Okay.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, he is, as I said, he's a great guy. I think he's wonderful. And you will enjoy this book. I'm now thinking that ever since I got the book, I got it. Of course, I always get books earlier than early. I got it quite a while ago. And so then I reread it, and the characters stay in my mind. It's always fun. And I wanted to just mention, sometimes, people will ask me, now after BoucherCon, the big convention for mystery writers, I had so much fun at the convention and got to meet so many people. And people ask me, how do I decide who to interview? First of all, I will tell you that I have rejected some famous author. I just mentioned it to somebody this morning that I have, on occasion, rejected some famous authors whose books I've received in advance. I always receive from the big publishers. They send me the books like at least 4 months beforehand. So I have the really first editions of a book. Sometimes even before, while they're still being proofed. So I get to read them early on, and I read all the books that I review. And then when I get a book, even if it's from somebody famous, if I don't like it, I'm not going to review it. And I've rejected at least two very, very famous, worldwide best-selling authors, because I knew that I know their work from previous books, because in most cases before I started this program, I was a great reader. I read 10,000 books at least, and so I know the author's works from the very beginning. And this is in the days even before internet, when I have the hard copies of these books, and I would read them, and I get to know authors, and I have this kind of memory that I can remember. I don't remember, it's not a photographic memory, but I have page memory where I can see a page in my mind, and I will see it, and it comes back to me. So I recognize when an author is not being, well, I can recognize when an author has turned over his work to somebody else. And now that's fine to do if you tell people about it, and then I talk to the guy or gal who wrote it. But when they don't tell you, and then they want me to review their books, and I know that they haven't written the books, I don't review them. So there are times that I reject absolutely famous people, and I take somebody who's not so famous, like Mark LaPorta, because he wrote this book for sure. He's got some strange mind, wonderfully strange mind. He's got a lot of ideas in his head, and a lot of, you could, as you listen to him talk, he lives with these people. These are people in his head. And so that's why the book is realistic. So that's how I make the decision. I received two books this morning, and I'll tell you, one of them is so bad, I couldn't believe that anybody published it. And then the second one I got was, I started reading it. I almost was late for starting the program today because I was so fascinated by it. And I'm so happy that it's written by a Youper, somebody from Michigan, Upper Peninsula, and he's writing about Marquette, Michigan, and all the places I know. And in addition, the book is just very fascinating. So I'm going to invite him on the program. The other guy who wrote, sent me this book, again, famous publishing company. I would barely touch it. You know, the corner of the book, I read like seven pages and I said, okay, I don't think so. So, you know, I do make the decision based on whether or not I think a book is worthy of being read. And as Mark said, you could hear the joy in his voice as he talks about his characters, as he talks about writing and the love of writing. And this is something that, you know, I discovered so much at BoucherCon, that all of the authors there would write even if they didn't get paid. They would just be writing because the ideas are in their head, the people, the characters are in their head, and they get so excited about it, and they know these people so well. And like Lee Child, who I'm looking at right now because it's so funny. I love this photo of him. Lee started writing when he was 39 years old because he was fired. He was fired from his job. He had no money and he started writing. And you can do it too, because you never know, you know, what's in you until you actually get out there and try it and persevere and dare. Exactly what Mark LaPorta said. You dare. You just say, I can do it. I have this knowledge. I know what I want to say. And then you just set this time aside and start writing. So it's just, that's why I love so much talking to authors, because I love their enthusiasm. And I hope that you pick this up, and that you, whether it's a memoir of your family or a cookbook or a book for children, a book to inspire children. I just love when an author has a passion for something. So that's all I can say today, because I am exhausted and I have to go. But I just want to say one more thing. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them on an audible book. And I am really, really fond of audible books now. There's so many wonderful ones, and anything by Julia Whalen is worth listening to. And she was on the program a month ago. And so just enjoy yourself today. Say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because he's always so nice to me. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And I might become a drill sergeant. I have to find some like auxiliary group I can become a drill sergeant. I would love it. Okay, bye-bye now.